Hey, James.
Hey, Greg.
How are we doing today?
I'm tired.
You're tired?
Yeah, tired.
I'm a little sad today.
And that's different than usual because...
Well, you yelled at me the other day.
Oh, I did, yes.
I was not happy.
Yeah. Sorry.
You don't need to yell.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
Yep.
Learn how to text without your caps locks on.
Okay, Grandpa. Okay.
Get the F off my lawn, man.
There, you feel better now?
I feel a little better now.
A little kumbaya circle for Greg.
I needed it. That was a little cathartic for me. I needed to say that.
Okay, good.
These loud text messages. Don't like it. Mm-hmm. So today is the 22nd of January. I do have to call out, I spent, how many times did I listen to Bat Outta Hell yesterday? Probably 8 or 9.
Right.
I listened through. So we lost Meatloaf, mm-hmm. which is, for anyone remotely near our ages or older for that matter, that was a quintessential part of youth, that it's album.
Transcendent.
Oh. I looked at my 14-year-old, who's very into music, and I mentioned something yesterday, but I said, you know, Meatloaf died, and she looks at me, and it was like I had said, you know, Carpet took a ride on a bicycle. Like, she had no idea what Meatloaf, what does that mean, Meatloaf died? Is that code for dinner? And mm-hmm. I'm just like, and I looked at my wife, and I looked back at my daughter, I'm like, oh, I have failed.
That's awful.
The problem is that it's such amazing stuff, and yet I'm not going to listen to Paradise by the Dashboard Light with my 14-year-old.
Yeah, no, I'll take a pass on that one.
I'm just like, you should listen to this, but not with me there. I'm not joking. I just had that album on repeat all day yesterday. That's just so many memories. I remember buying that as a used cassette when I went away to college.
Wow.
I think nice. I still have the cassette, too.
My neighbor had it on vinyl, and I just remember
holding
that album sleeve and just looking at the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that is badass.
Oh, there was so much going on in that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, rest in peace.
Yep.
Mr. Loaf. Now I'll detour to something a little bit funny. A friend of mine posted something yesterday. They get emails from Weber, the grill company,
mm-hmm,
every
mm-hmm.
Friday, and this actually happened yesterday. There is a Friday recipe that they send out. Well, Meatloaf died Thursday night. The Friday recipe was a grilled meatloaf recipe.
Nice.
And shortly after sending it, Weber sent an apology to everyone, right. Which I read and which was so funny, basically saying we sent that was our plan for the recipe for Friday. We completely missed the fact that that would be very insensitive with the passing of the rock star Meatloaf, and we are truly sorry that we did that. Whereas I'm thinking it was a beautiful tribute. So
I know, right?
I don't know. Someone somewhere got triggered and wrote back to them and said that was a horrible thing to do, which mm-hmm. I, you know, snowflake.
Well, I would have figured that was you, what with me yelling at you in caps on text.
So. I was a little off kilter. But, you know, I still don't think I would have taken umbrage at the Weber people for a Meatloaf recipe. I think that's... Mm-hmm. Look, the man called himself Meatloaf. He had,
right.
you know, he had to have some thick skin.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for your music, sir. Now, back to your regularly scheduled merriment.
Yeah. Merriment. Mm-hmm. Rambling.
I am going to post this week's, this podcast in all caps, and we'll just see what people react to that. Yeah. All caps with things spelled weird because I think from today's topic, photosynthesis will be the only word that looks normal.
No, this one isn't that bad. Although it is sciencey science.
It is sciencey science.
Yeah, it is sciencey science. We're going to talk about light today. I know we've talked about light in the past, mm-hmm. very specific to photosynthesis. The last time we talked in real depth, we talked about phytochrome and cryptochrome and what. How the difference between red light and far red light wavelengths change things in the plant physiologically. Man, that's just the tip of the iceberg, how plants respond to light.
And as an aside, if you watch our dark web podcast, we'll tell you we can bring you into the darkness.
Darkness is also very important,
mm-hmm.
right? You can't have the light without the dark. happens. So it's yin and yang. So just get comfy with that. But yeah, I wanted to talk a bit about this this concept of light and other sensory inputs that the plant uses light for, other than just straight up photosynthesis, which is kind of important. There's so much else going on here. And as I'm thinking about and reading through the Discord and looking at questions people are asking, ultimately, this is what it comes down to. How in the hell do I know what's going on in my plant with as complex as things are? I mean, honestly, how do I know?
You don't. You don't. It's a mystery.
you really don't. People are like, well, you know, how do I manage my hop yard? You don't we are not managers of hops, okay? We are caretakers, because that plant's going to do whatever the hell it wants. And frankly, we know a teeny tiny bit about what goes on inside that plant. So who are we to call ourselves managers at that point? Like, you're actually manipulating the environment to get it to do exactly what you want? No, you're just trying to not screw anything up. That's the best that you're going to do.
I wish I had some artistic capability, because a little picture of a hop cone yelling, "You're not the boss of me," just feels perfect right now.
That's pretty much it, right? So this whole concept of horticulture in hops, there's a few other plants that are like this too, but is almost kind of laughable, because we can't – there are a few things that we can do from a physical manipulation standpoint that impacts – yield and productivity, right? We've talked about timing of things and training and pruning and stuff like that. Well, what you're doing, but you're not altering the plant's production potential, right? You're not forcing it to change its physiology. You're not telling it it's going to grow a certain way in order to change what its natural habit is. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot for people to get their head around. What we're doing with hops is we're trying to optimize the conditions to allow that plant to reach its full potential. We are never going to, at least in my lifetime, going to know enough about this plant to actually force it to do something it doesn't want to do.
Well, but isn't that, especially with hydroponics, and isn't that the intent, to try and fool the plant into different seasons and different day lengths and all that?
Again, that goes back to manipulating the environment around it. Mm-hmm. To try and get that plant to do what it's going to do itself. Now, if we were to say, you know what, I'm going to put this plant, this hop plant, in a specially controlled chamber, and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z to it in order to make it grow twice as many cones. No, you're not going to do that, because that is genetically determined. Mm-hmm. That plant's going to do what it wants. If you're going to try and affect that plant with external growth hormones to shorten its node length, will that work? Well, no, because we've tried it and it doesn't work. So that kind of traditional agronomy and horticulture isn't going to work, adding those exogenous, as we call them, hormones to tell the plant to do something else. No.
That's how we build a bigger tomato and all that.
Pretty much, yeah. So really what you're left with in affecting the performance of hops in the field is breeding. Mm-hmm. You know, monkeying around with the genetics in order to get it to do something new. There's no amount of horticulture that's going to hyper optimize the production of that plant. Not going to happen. So get over yourself. We are at best caretakers. We're there to provide a system, a growing environment, that has been as optimized as it possibly can for that plant to perform to its maximum genetic potential. That's all we do. Growers that are just like, how do I triple my yield? Well, if you're already at, let's say, 1,500 pounds per acre for Centennial, you're not gonna.
Right. You've optimized your system at that point.
It's pretty optimized. You may have certain years where something is better and you don't know what, and it tweaks it, and you're at 1700 and you're like, woohoo, I had a good year, or a better year. A good year is 1500 pounds. Now, some of you who have Centennial are like, 1500 pounds, holy hell, what would I do with that? I'm at 200 pounds. Okay, your system isn't optimized. Right. Right. So now you have to look at what are those input factors that you do have control over to give that plant everything that needs to perform to its genetic potential maximum. Horticulture is the science of tweaking those things as much as we can and, you know, reaping the benefits.
Yep.
But the flip side of that is, what about the things we can't control? How does that impact this, right? Mm-hmm. What do they do? You know, what are those stimuli that impact genetic potential in a negative or positive way? And it's like, well, James, I can't do anything about it. I understand that, but you need to know what it is,
right?
So that you can identify it when it happens, so that you're not thinking, oh man, my system's not optimized. You know what? You may have optimized it to, you know, 99%. But if Mother Nature's not playing ball, there's nothing else you can physically do.
And it's so important, you know, we've talked about design of experiments, and knowing what those things are help you remove them from the equation when you are trying to figure out what you've done that has or hasn't had an impact.
Right.
So you, before you assume that, what was the example we were using? This was a while ago. It's going to drive me nuts. I think it had to do with day length, where assumptions were being made that, well, the only thing that changed from this year to that year was X. Well, mm-hmm. No, because your rainfall changed and your
cloudy days
and all that stuff changed.
Yep.
And you have to be able to, maybe you can't remove those variables as variables, but you can at least account for them in your decision-making process.
Yeah, you need to. Yes, exactly right. Accounting for them. And in the act of accounting, in order to account for them appropriately, you need to know what they do, mm-hmm. what impact they have. And that's why I wanted to talk about light. We've talked about light very specifically in photosynthesis and in day length. But what are these other attributes of light that can impact your plant?
All right.
And you're like, okay, well, let's just grow them in a greenhouse then. Yeah, that don't work so well either for multiple reasons, but because you just can't fake the sun. Mm-hmm. So that's our 15-minute intro. That's that's what we're going to talk about today.
Well, show us the light.
Mm. Come to me, children. I am the light. let's see. To recap previous episodes briefly, light is measured in wavelengths. Light is energy, and this blows people's mind, and it's a particle. You're like, how can it be a energy and a particle at the same time? Mind blown. It's called quantum physics. So light is when we measure it, is a wavelength. So that's energy. That's how it travels. When we actually try and stop and measure it, it suddenly turns into a particle. It's very weird. Mm-hmm. And this is part of where physics turns into black magic. But what's important to understand is that for our intents and purposes, light travels in wavelengths. So just like, you know, ripples on a pond. And much like the people of Tonga found out recently with the gigantic volcanic eruption, the more energy you put into that wave in a tsunami, the more energy is behind it, right? The more force is behind it. And so in light, it has the same thing, right? So if you look at the total electromagnetic spectrum, and I encourage people when they're not driving to just Google the EM spectrum and you'll get a nice little diagram, and you'll see the entire spectrum, you know, goes from, you know, super long wave cosmic background radiation, which is energy left over from the formation of the universe that, yes, we can measure, all the way up to things like X-rays and gamma rays, which are like, nothing's stopping me. I'm going to bore right through everything. Those are high energy. Visible light is a very, very, very narrow spectrum inside of that, right? And on either side of that, you usually have radio waves and microwaves and things like that. Those are all part of the EM spectrum. Visible light, very small portion. But in that, we can break that energy down into high energy visible light and low energy visible light. And that's what we call the blue and the red spectrum. So if you're looking at, you know, A lights, let's say a stoplight, that red light, when it's on telling you to stop, That is long wavelength. So there's a long distance between the peaks of the wave. That green light, when it comes on, is closer to blue. That has higher energy. So those the distance between the crests of those waves are much narrower. And let's say over the distance of a meter, the number of crests that fit inside of that meter of blue light, there's more, right? There's more waves because that crest, the distance between those crests is shorter than there is for the red light. That means there's more energy packed into that same area than in blue light than there is in red light. Then if we go to the invisible spectrum of the blue light and the red light, you have infrared, which we can't see with our eyeballs. Some animals can. And then you have ultraviolet, which again, we can't see with our eyeballs, but some animals can. As we get closer into that ultraviolet range, we're getting narrower and narrower bands of waves. It starts to be able to do things like penetrate your skin and burn you, which is why we get sunburns. Mm-hmm. And as you get you continue down that path where those wavelengths get tighter and tighter and tighter, that's when you start getting into high, very high energy radiation, which is what causes cellular damage and whatnot, like gamma rays from nuclear explosions and waste and breakdown products. So anyway, the key thing to remember here is the closer to blue that you get, the higher energy the beam, the particle and the wave has, the closer to red you get, the lower energy it is. This matters to the plant because think about, so this plant, it's not like it can get up and move, right? Yet.
Sure.
I haven't seen it yet.
Yet.
I don't know. We'll see.
I've seen Day of the Triffids. I know how this turns out for us.
I lean more toward Little Shop of Horrors myself.
Okay. All right. This plant has to be able to cope with the environment that it's in because it can't, in order for it to tolerate. So a plant has two ways to avoid stress. It can tolerate it or it can avoid it. That's tolerance or avoidance. I shouldn't say avoid stress, handle stress. Mm-hmm. Tolerance or avoidance. It can't really avoid the sunlight, right? So it's like, okay, I'm going to tolerate it. Some plants, though, do avoid it. Mm-hmm. Those are the plants that are shade-loving plants.
Well, and honestly, if the plants that spend enough time with you with the dark cloud that follows you everywhere, that's a pretty good way to be a shade-loving plant.
There, it's got lots of hostas around me all everywhere I go.
Uh-huh.
So, there's a little inside horticulture joke there for you. So, you totally derailed my train of thought here. Thank you. All right, so shade-loving plants, mm-hmm. So things that grow like in the understory of a forest, those plants have adapted to grow in low-light conditions. If you put them in high-light conditions where it's not just the intensity of light that's hitting it, it's also the wavelength because the wavelength is being filtered through the canopy of, let's say, the forest, such that, and it's trending more towards long-wave radiation. More towards infrared and long wave red, so lower energy, because all the other leaves and whatnot are blocking the higher energy wavelengths. Now you move that plant out into the bright sunshine. Two things happen. One, it can't handle the amount of little light particles that's hitting the leaf, and because it screws up its physiology. And equally, or even more importantly, the amount of blue light that's hitting that plant as opposed to red light is screwing up the plant hormones because plant hormones, some of them are triggered by what wavelength of light hits the leaf.
Okay.
That's crazy talk. Really? How does that work? So you're telling me the chemicals in the plant can tell what wavelength of light it is? Yeah. Just like the photosynthesis part one was all about chlorophyll and the little antennas that it has, molecular antennas it has hanging out there, is only responsive to a couple of wavelengths of light. That's it. Likewise, these plant growth hormones are also receptive to certain wavelengths of light that tell them to turn on or turn off. Now, that creates a really interesting thing that we can do in the laboratory. because we can say, you know what, I'm only going to put this plant under red light and let's see what happens.
Okay.
Or I'm going to put it under only blue light, literally put filters, you know, gels on these lights. So now with LEDs, you can control the wavelength very accurately. And let's see what happens. And lo and behold, weird shit occurs. When we look at the red and the blue light response, if anyone has ever grown seedlings, you know, seeds, I'm going to start my garden, right, for the spring. And you're doing it, you're just going to put them in your window. It's, let's say you live in part of a hemisphere that actually has seasons. You're doing this in the wintertime to get ready for spring. And at that point, the quality of light is usually pretty low. And by quality of light, what I mean is it's usually very heavy on the red and far red spectrum because the angle of the sun is much further down on the horizon. And that's that much more atmosphere that the light has to pass through. And thank God our light filters high energy light. Otherwise, we would all be fried to a crisp. So the more red light gets through, the further the more atmosphere the light has to travel through. That intense or high volume of quantity of red light tells that plant to turn on certain hormones, auxins and IAA, indole-acetic acid. And it causes that seedling to grow really long, and we call it leggy sometimes. It's just like, why is this thing just growing nothing but stem? And it usually bends towards the window. That's mm-hmm. called phototropism. And so you get these
straining
really,
for the light, basically.
It's the growing tip of that plant called the apical meristem is sensing the wavelength of light. And it's also sensing which direction the light's coming from, because it wants to grow towards the light to optimize the angle at which the light is hitting its leaves. So it's going to be like, turn into light, right? Because that's the direction the beams are coming, and I don't want them coming edge on my leaf. Otherwise, I'm not going to get any photosynthesis. I need to change my attitude so that I can intercept those light particles. So the way the plant does that is through phototropism. And we see this every day, multiple times a day, as our plants, hot plants, wind themselves around the twine. That's phototropism. So the way the plant, a hot plant climbs, doesn't have tendrils, right? It's got hooks on its vine. The plant needs to physically wind itself around something, and it gets its cues to do that by the sun as it passes through the sky. Because I don't care what hemisphere you live on this planet, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, north or south.
More or less, right? Yeah.
More or less, right? So that plant, there's a reason why it twines clockwise, because it's picking up that sun in the morning with its far red light. Because, you know, as it's coming up on the horizon, it's coming through more atmosphere. It's not, the sun's not right overhead. So if you, yeah. if you take a sphere, right, you do the whole drawing, you see that the rays of the sun are traveling through more volume of atmosphere. So it's filtering out more blue light. It's leaving the red and the far red light. So the plant, the very growing tip, is picking that light up and be like, oh, hey, this is mostly red light. Let's start twining, right? So it starts to move. And then as the sun comes up higher over the in the day, right, it's coming overhead, and sometimes it actually, depending on where you're at in the latitude, it can actually, it doesn't come directly overhead, it actually kind of goes behind you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That apical meristem is sensing where that light is, as well as what the quality of light is, the red light versus the blue light, and those differences in wavelengths, because as it's directly overhead, it's passing through less atmosphere, therefore you have more blue light compared to the ratio of the red and the far red light. And that turns on and off different plant hormones that say, okay, stop. So it stops for a little bit, you know, twining. And then as the sun starts to go down, again, we go back to that. We get a different balance between red light and blue light, and it starts to twine again. So that act of starting and stopping and following the sun through the sky is what causes the tip of that plant to spiral. in a clockwise direction.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now here's a question, and I'm going to ask a question that you might not know the answer to. You say that it's following the pattern and it's following the sun. Has there anything ever been studied on whether there's learning going on? Do the plants at times learn to anticipate what's going to happen? Because it's not like they can just decide, plants don't change direction quickly.
Right. Not in the way that you think.
Okay.
So they're not making a conscious decision.
Mm-hmm.
So can they anticipate something's going to happen? Yes, they can. And the way that happens is through ratios of different chemicals. Like we talked about in red versus far red light, phytochrome versus cryptochrome. When far red light hits a plant, you get more cryptochrome production. And then that cryptochrome decays over time if it's not exposed to that far red light, such that it changes the ratio between those two chemicals. So it can start anticipating. It's like, okay, these are getting closer. These are getting closer to parity. The phytochrome is going to take over. That's going to mean that something's going to happen, right? That could either be, in this case, it's time. So that usually means, well, okay, the sun's going to come up soon. So I better open my stomata and get rid of my gas buildup that I had. So basically the morning farts. Get all the morning farts out. And then, boom, the sun comes up and I'm off again. So yes, plants can anticipate, but they're not doing it based on cognitive learning. They're doing it based on physiological ratios.
Needs. Okay.
Right.
They're playing to their need. Gotcha.
Yep, exactly. Huh. So now some of you are probably thinking, oh, wait a minute, in the greenhouse, the lights aren't moving and these plants still twine. You're correct. It is a genetic predisposition for these plants to wind themselves, not necessarily because of the angle and the position of the sun, but because of the change, more about the change in the quality of light and the type of light they're getting. Because you're not growing these plants, it's a greenhouse, it's not a closet, right? So there is outside influence from the photoperiod, right, that's impacting these plants to do what they're doing. Can you change the rate of twining of these plants if you grow them in a growth chamber and control the wavelengths of light and the photoperiod? Absolutely. You can absolutely do that. You can make plants, you know, these hops grow that barely twine at all. They still will because they are genetically driven to do so. But it's, you know, and where they might, instead of doing 4 or 5 twirls a day, they may do 1 or not even 1. But when you start goofing around with that kind of stimulus, you're totally fucking up the rest of the plant's physiology. So it's not like you're like, hey, I could create some really cool stuff if I do this in the basement. I'm like, yeah, but you're not going to be happy with the result.
None of our hobnologists are going to goof around with.
Oh, you know, of course. No, absolutely
come on,
not.
Come
nope,
on.
Nope.
Give them next some, week. Give them some credit.
Next week, we'll see somebody partitioning off their basement to run some experiments.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all that's great, as one of my team members says. All that's great, but what about this? Think about it like this. What conditions are we exposed to in the hop yard, our plants exposed to in the hop yard, that could affect the quality of light that they're getting, red light versus blue light, let's say? What do you think?
What's the biggest thing besides night and day, duh?
You can't to affect the red light and blue light in the actual yard, in an outdoor hop yard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, from everything you've said, we can't control that. I mean, something we can control or something that would affect it?
Something that we cannot control.
Oh, clouds.
exactly. Cloudy, 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 cloudy. What, it's the simple. Do you get sunburnt more easily on a heavily overcast day or a bright sunny day? Right. Bright sunny right. day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a reason for that, because the clouds, the water molecules that are in those clouds are scattering that high energy wavelength.
Now, I just want to say something before you go further. You, because as a longtime teenage lifeguard, people will burn more on an overcast day because they assume they need zero protection.
Correct.
So you're still, absolutely. You will still get some amount coming through, and yep. we are we're sort of lulled into a false sense of security.
Absolutely, we are.
Yeah, cloud cover doesn't mean nothing's making its way through.
Nope. And that's usually amplified by the fact that you're near open water, and that reflects high energy, just like the reason why it doesn't make it through the clouds, because those water droplets are scattering it. That UV is hitting the water surface. That's a nice flat plane. and bouncing it. Case in point, I was in Phoenix for vacation one time, and we were sitting in the shade. I had sunscreen on, but I was sitting in the shade on a lounge chair with my feet pointed at the pool that was in the sun. The bottom of my feet got fried. So there you go. And you want to talk about a sucky vacation. Burn the bottom of your feet.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, all I could do there is lay there and drink fat tire all day. It was awful.
Oh,
wow.
I can't tell if you're being serious or not.
I was being serious, but it was not awful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so yeah, cloud cover. Cloud cover and its intensity, like its thickness and how much water vapor is in the air, will change the amount of red light versus blue light that gets through. The long wave radiation, the infrared radiation, will penetrate, right? Not as good as obviously will with non-cloudy days, because typically also when there's a heavy cloud cover, it's also cooler, right? You're right. Not getting as much of that infrared radiation penetrating, but it's going to scatter the blue light. So you're going to change that ratio. And when the plant is extremely sensitive to very narrow bands of wavelengths of light, putting it in conditions, not a day here or a day there. Or, yeah, I've had a few cloudy days in a row, like weeks of cloud cover. Suddenly, Shit gets weird, right? So we talked about this, I think, last week or the week before in alpha acid production, where you actually need incident solar radiation. You need light, usually in the UV spectrum, hitting those cones in order to transform the beta acids into alpha acids. So here's an example of where the wavelength of light, if you have heavy clouds or in a cloudy season, more cloud days versus sundays, you will see a depression in alpha acids and an increase in beta acids. Why? Because you had no UV to catalyze that reaction, or less UV. Same thing goes with activating some of these plant hormones that do things like, sidearm formation. burr cone formation. So if you start goofing around with the ratio of red to blue light, you can force plants to flower early. It's a stress response. So I know some folks, I believe in this particular case, one of our hopnologists in South Africa was like, why suddenly all my plants flowered really early? They didn't, some of them didn't even make it to the top. You know, everything else was the same. He's like, I didn't do anything. Everything else, you know, I've got everything else is spot on. Okay, what then can't you control? What are your sun versus cloud days?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, man, it's been really overcast. Bing, 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 bing. There you go.
Huh.
You're like, son of a bitch, what do I do? Nothing. you want to put lights in your yard to increase, you know, different wavelengths? Would that work? It would have some effect, yeah. As is evident by our friends in Australia who are using lights in their yard to adjust the photo period to improve their flowering timing.
Hmm. Man, that has to be expensive.
I don't have a say in that. I don't know what you want to be saying that. Expensive compared to what? Not doing it? Probably. But if you don't do it, are you going to get any flowering? No. So if you want to be in the business, that's a cost of doing business. Is it more expensive than somebody growing in, let's say, my latitude? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But if they can charge the price that they need to for it, does it matter?
No. Yeah, I guess that's true. And you know, we've talked many, many times about the little yellow notebook and keeping track of your data. All of these articles that we've read so you don't have to over the years that talk about the annual hop production in various parts of the world, they always reference below or above average overcast days. It's something that is tracked, and it's something you should be tracking so that you do understand year over year what's going on and what, as we said before, what you have to account for.
Knowing why something happened, even if it's not something you can affect, is just as valid as knowing something that you can't affect. Mm-hmm. So just because you're like, well, I can't do anything about it, James, so why does it matter? But you will know why something happened then and not be wondering if it's something you did right or wrong.
Yep. And remembering anecdotally, oh, yeah, it's been cloudy. That doesn't cut it. It doesn't cut it. It right. Whether or not it's been cloudy lately depends on the mood I'm in when you ask me that question.
Correct. So going back to our weather station episode from eons ago, right? That's what they're usually called PAR, photosynthetically active radiation sensors, or even just incident solar radiation. It's not going to tell you whether it's day or night. It's going to tell you how much energy is hitting that sensor and is hitting your plants. That's going to tell you a lot when you finally come down to you're looking at your weather station. It's like, how many sun versus cloud days do I have? Well, okay, this is what my data say. Well, how cloudy was it? Mm-hmm. And that's going to tell you a lot about the response that your plants are showing you so that you can suddenly say, okay, this response I'm seeing and this one, I can just take off of my list of horticultural practices I need to consider because there's nothing I can do about it anyway. I know why it's happening. So just don't even think about it.
Yep.
And that can be critically important when we're trying to figure out what the hell am I supposed to do with my plants? Why am I not getting the yield that I have? Why am I having early flowering? Why am I having too much top growth? All of these things you need to consider what factors in the environment can you affect and what ones can you not affect.
Sure.
And that'll help you make those determinations on why something happened. For instance, there could be a scenario where you have heavy overcast days, right, during production season. And this doesn't usually happen, but it could. And elevated temperatures. When that happens, when you have heavy overcast days and elevated temperatures, it means you usually also have very high humidity. So now what you've got is you've got poor light quality, low light intensity, and heat stress and difficulty and challenges around evapotranspiration. All of those things the plant needs in order to photosynthesize optimally. Mm-hmm. Now you've just gone and screwed up its food source and its breathing source. I would expect that your yield is not going to be very good that year, no matter how well you controlled downy mildew and timed your fertilizer applications and got your training right. But the first thing people want to do is look, they think that it's something that they did that caused this, and it's something that they have to adjust in their practice, and it isn't always the case.
Well, sure. I mean, you want to believe, look, you want to believe you have some level of control.
You don't. You don't. It's like, that's why we farmers always say, every time we talk to each other, it's like, how's it going this year? Living the dream. Right? You're rolling the dice every single time you roll a dice. Why? I don't gamble, because I used to gamble every day farming. So that's the best you can do. Know why something occurs so that you know how to affect the things you actually have control over mm-hmm. and the ones that you don't.
Yep. What's that prayer? Grant me the serenity to change the things I can and accept the things I can't. Something along those lines.
And not strangle the people that piss me off.
That should be added to it.
Yeah. That's the end of the James's hymn too. Yeah. Children, I am the light.